Midlands today on Midlands 103 with Tullamore Motors. The Renault Capture. Capture life. TullamoreMotors.ie. When people in the Midlands want to talk, they talk to Will Faulkner.
Good morning, happy Friday. Any nice plans for the weekend? I'm heading to Forest Fest. Hope to see you there. Lots happening around the region though, and we'll cover as much as we can between now and 12, including if prices are going up because of COVID first and then the war in Ukraine, how does raising your mortgage rate help the situation? The Hill of Ushnock is tentatively listed as a World Heritage Site. What do the buzzwords mean? And AIB is told by no less than Taoiseach Micheál Martin that it should not close ATMs in Rathdowney, Birr and Edenderry. Will the bank listen to the government? We'll see. When you call 0818 300 103 is the Midlands 103 comment line. You can text or WhatsApp 083 30 10 103, powered by Lamb Brothers Toyota in Tullamore. Get me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Lots of ways to get involved. Now, what is on the front pages this morning? The Irish Times is first to hand. And we've got, yes, the one you will feel in your pocket if you're paying a tracker or a variable rate mortgage. Time will tell on the latter. But the European Central Bank raised its rate by half of 1% yesterday. Not a quarter, as many believed. They've gone further to a full half a percentage point increase. And there will be another review in September. And their ambition, of course, is to take some of the heat out of the economy, reduce the amount of money flowing around, reduce the amount of investment, and therefore bring down inflation. Whether it'll work, of course, is anybody's guess, because inflation is very much a product of energy prices at the moment, food shortages as a result of the war in Ukraine. Although there is a bit of hope on that. Ditch the Irish Times. I did see another story that perhaps will make a big difference to people, especially in the developing world. Ukraine and Russia have done a deal to unblock exports of grain from Ukraine and to relieve some of the pressure on gas to European countries in return. And this will hopefully take a bit of the pressure out of the inflationary situation. The journal.ie reports it today. It's actually the first time since the war broke out that Ukraine and Russia have done a deal on anything. So a little bit of progress there. What else have we got on the front pages? The Irish Daily Star. Sore tackle. It talks of the Garda inspector who put it to a defendant yesterday that there was no attempt to tackle for the ball in an incident where a GAA player had his scrotum ripped in a game. The accused was accused of ripping his rival's privates in a game. I'm not laughing at the incident itself, just the mere thought of it. I'm sure any man listening has that clench whenever you hear of such an injury. And it has ended up in court, and we'll see what the outcome is when eventually a decision is reached. The Irish Independent again covers the mortgage rate issue. Donoghue blindsided, it says as well, about the plan by banks, AIB in this case, to shut ATMs in 70 locations, including three here in the Midlands. There was no consultation in advance, and the government is left with a sour taste in its mouth, especially since AIB did this when the Dáil was in recess. And then you see on the main picture there, Beverly Cooper Flynn. She's the former TD in Mayo, and she's playing in the Oireachtas Golf Society annual outing. Yes, they're back at it. No golf gate this time, we hope. And you can see she's taking a swing in County Wicklow. The president of the society, though, is Donny Cassidy. Donny is a former Westmeath TD. And he said, everybody is delighted to be back. Asher, isn't it nice? Get together and have a bit of golf in Wicklow. No doubt. Where are we going inside the papers? This is an incredible story, actually. A six-year-old girl, when her mother collapsed and suffered a stroke in Longwood in County Meath, she responded perfectly with clarity of thought, despite only being 60 years of age. Her mum is Dee Dixon, and Dee had only turned 40 when she woke up at 7:30 in the morning, July 18th last year. She felt a bit unwell, and it was like she stood up too fast after getting out of bed. You know that dizzy feeling? So she fell back down, and her daughter came in, and her daughter began crying beside her. Dee couldn't work out why, and then she realised she couldn't move her entire body. But even though her little girl was traumatised, she had the presence of mind to go and get the keys, knew exactly where they were, open up the front door, go outside, get help, get the neighbours in, and thankfully and luckily, and fingers crossed, all worked out well in the end. That story highlighted in the Irish Times today. You never want your child to have that sort of experience, do you? Grinds are very, very pricey, and many students, unfortunately, find themselves needing grinds every, particularly April, May, June, cramming in towards the final days before the exam. And the question is asked in the Irish Independent today, would shorter secondary school holidays mean less need for those pricey grinds? And there are many countries in the world with a longer academic year than we have here in Ireland. And it works out that the average cost of grinds is €450. In many cases, it can be more. And the big stumbling block to this, of course, is teachers' unions will not willingly extend the school year unless they get something back in return for their members. And that's what unions are there for, after all, to strike a deal. But would you be in favour of longer secondary school hours? More days, shorter holidays? 083 30 10 103 on text and WhatsApp. Now, I want to point something out. And to be fair, lots of people over the last few weeks, whenever we've talked about the energy crisis and climate change and the role of households and the role of so many other sections of society, farmers, for instance, a few people have put up their hands and said, what about aviation? What about the role of all these planes in the sky emitting all that jet fuel? And what about the super wealthy who fly here, there and everywhere willy-nilly? Well, you can pick up the Irish Times today because they've done an expose on different celebs such as Kylie Jenner, who took her private jet in California on a flight that lasted just 17 minutes. But in taking her 17-minute flight, she would have emitted 1 ton of carbon, which is nearly what you, I and the average Joe Soap would emit in a full year. That would be our global footprint individually, 1 ton of carbon. She did it in 17 minutes. Mark Wahlberg was in Ireland, and he took a 23-minute flight from Dublin to Shannon. And again, you're looking at about a ton of carbon. I'm not sure what a ton of carbon looks like, but anyway, that's how they measure it. And they also said that when he took his private jet back to California, he, this is where it gets really, really into bamboozling numbers, but he would have been responsible for over 33 tons of carbon. So like 33 people in a whole year would have done as much damage to the environment as he did in the space of a few hours flying home. That's aviation for you. Anyway. Vladimir Putin is not unhealthy, according to the Russians. Naturally enough, they deny there's any ill health going on, even though he was pictured several times in recent weeks, looking shaky, looking bloated. He was left standing waiting for President Erdogan of Turkey a few days ago. Didn't look too happy about it. But now even the CIA says, actually, he's fine. And to quote the director of the CIA, William Burns, he's too healthy. So Mr. Burns was at a briefing yesterday. He said, there are lots of rumours about President Putin's health, and as far as we know, as far as we can tell, he's entirely too healthy. And he said, that's not a formal intelligence judgment, by the way. And I'm sure that'll go down well in Moscow. President Putin, too healthy. Final stories for you. Do you remember the national lottery jackpot reached 19 million euro last year and it could not be given away for love nor money? It went weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. And eventually, they had a special draw and gave all the money away. But according to the accounts for the national lottery, that period, those 3 months during which the jackpot sat there, they made 180 million quid in additional revenue by just having the jackpot sit there. Now, of course, they would insist this was random and it wasn't set up and so on. But it was a fortunate turn of events for the books. 180 million euro in extra revenue, which let's see how much of that trickles down into prizes and good causes and so on. Remember, the National Lottery has been privatised, so some of it will trickle through and a lot of it will just go back to the owners. And one last story for you. Actually, I'm going to take a moment and pause for the cause, because the FLA is coming to Mullingar in just a couple of days' time. 31st is the official launch, the official kickoff day, and it runs from that Sunday to the following Sunday, and it will bring 500,000 people to Mullingar. And there, let's just call a spade, there are some negative feelings about that from a minority, probably, but let's address what the concerns are. And one man, one local businessman, has put together a very eloquent letter, which I want to read to you. I'm not going to do it just now. We'll do it in a few minutes' time. On the question of grinds and whether a longer school year would remove the need for many students to get the extra tuition, Cliona, thanks for your message. You're a student teacher almost at the end of your course. And in your experience, the extra school days wouldn't solve the issue of students needing grinds, because usually those who need them, they need one-to-one help. And that's not possible in classes, no matter how many classes are held in a year. That's a good point. Grinds offer you that individual focus, which when there are 20, 25, 30 people, who knows how big some of the classes are, you're just not going to get that dedicated focus, are you? Or do you disagree? Do you think a longer school year is the answer, because the curriculum can often be rushed, especially in those latter months? Tomás Nally has wrote a letter to us, and he is the manager of Rochford's in Dominic Street, Mullingar, so right in the heart of the town, which in a little over a week will host 500,000 visitors for Fla Ceolna Héireann. For the first time in 3 years that the event has been held because of COVID-19. So great excitement in some quarters and less excitement in others, apparently. But he writes as a businessman who says he has grown up living and working on the main street in Mullingar, but he has been shocked and extremely concerned about some of the negative attention and opinions with regard to the upcoming FLA. And he says, from talking to other business people and customers, I also firmly believe this negative view is a minority opinion, as 95% of the people I have interacted with on the issue realise just how huge an opportunity this is for Mullingar and its people. To put things in context, he says, this is not merely a festival. It is the biggest and longest running festival on the entire island of Ireland. It has a cult following of diehard patrons who have not been in attendance for 3 years, and it's coming home to its birthplace. This is literally Croke Park Sunday, 7 days a week. And it is being handed to the business people and community of Mullingar on a plate. And he says, I personally take great issue with anyone who says there's been no consultation or we haven't been given any information. He says there have been a massive number of meetings, emails, letters, radio interviews, social media posts, advertisements, information put on websites. It's all accessible. Nobody has the right to say they haven't been given information. You need to seek this information for yourself, as it is impossible to contact people on an individual basis to provide these details. He goes on to say, the project has been in the pipeline for over 4 years. 4 years of relentless, hard work by the FLA committee, who have chased down every avenue and every lead to bring this immense opportunity to the town. They are all volunteers. They've put their own time into this event. They have sacrificed their personal lives, their work, their family, through the biggest pandemic any of us have ever seen, in order to bring this project to fruition, and they should be commended from the highest heights for doing so. It is easy to throw stones from the sidelines at people who put their heads above the parapet and try to do something for the community, and the negative comments portrayed by a minority are nothing short of disgraceful, he says. The entire FLA committee, led by Joe Kinnair, Westmeath County Council, Mullingar Chamber of Commerce, the Gorthy, the local representatives, they should all be lauded for making this dream a reality and landing it on our doorsteps. The streets have been awash with council workers busily readying the town and doing magnificent work, and we are therefore going to be prepared for the massive crowds that descend upon us. And furthermore, the business people of the town have been given an impetus to improve their shop fronts, improve their premises, and ultimately that will enhance our community for everybody's benefits. Now, there are some, he says, who ask, how will I benefit from the FLA? The reality is, if you stand outside with Rice Krispie buns, you'll be sold out in 10 minutes. There may be some whose weekly shopping is disrupted for 1 week, but ultimately that's a minor inconvenience to allow an event that'll bring millions to the local economy and put money back in people's pockets locally during a bleak winter. And Tom Nally says, from organising the Westmeath Bachelor Festival, I understand just how hard it is to pull off an event, and ours was only a drop in the ocean compared with the FLA. This is an event like no other. There are hundreds of towns, hundreds of them, around the country that would be crying out to have this after such a bleak few years. We have an opportunity in the first week of August to show the entire country and the world just how much of an amazing place Mullingar is. We have an opportunity to stand up and be counted as one of the best towns in Ireland. We need to stand together. Embrace this opportunity together. Mullingar is a unique and vibrant town, and we must send the message that we want and need this event, not just this year, but in the coming years as well. And Tomás Nally concludes by writing, I would ask that if you have listened to this so far, you join me and the vast majority of businesses and local people in commending the FLA committee and the local authorities, the groups, the representatives, for all of their hard work to date. Send them a message. Give them your support. They need it and they thoroughly deserve it. Hear, hear. That's from Tomás Nally in Rochfords in Mullingar. Now, changing gears for a moment, the number of assaults on staff in our hospitals, let's just quantify this. According to the HSE, 262 such incidents were reported by healthcare staff in the last month. 262 in the space of 30 days. And those are just the ones that are reported. Albert Murphy joins us. He's from the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. Mullingar Hospital happens to fall into his brief. Albert, good morning.
Good morning, Will.
We've had this conversation before, probably far more than once, and there have been various signs placed in emergency departments, for instance, warning about attacks on staff or abuse towards staff. There's been much discussion about strengthening the law and enforcement and so on. Are we making any dent?
We last spoke about this, Will, in March, and roughly the figures were the same, that there were 6 in 7 nurses being assaulted on a daily basis in our hospitals throughout the country. And the sad reflection is it's not improving. We wrote to the Health and Safety Authority earlier this year because we're very concerned as relation to the number of inspections that they're actually carrying out. If you can imagine, 1 in 3 people working in the country work in some form of healthcare as workers. For the last year that the figures were available, there was, which is 2020, there was in health, there was 1,715 incidents reported to the authority, and they carried out 197 inspections. Whereas in manufacturing, there was 1,255 incidents, and yet there was over 1,200 inspections, and the same in farming and construction. So we are fairly critical of the Health and Safety Authority, and we wrote to them saying that they needed to step up a gear in relation to the number of inspections that they're carrying out to ensure compliance with the legislation. And we have specifically requested that they would establish a division to ensure that the safety regimes in hospitals and other healthcare settings are improving. We've looked for that meeting with them. We haven't got that meeting yet. But the evidence that we're getting is that, you know, that nurses and midwives are getting all sorts of abuse, and hence from verbal abuse up to physical abuse for people that have now, unfortunately, can't go back into the workplace because they're traumatised by what's happened in some cases. But some cases it's just low-level intimidation and aggression that's going on a daily basis.
This is probably hard to capture in figures, but I just want a sense from you. How much of this is where a patient is disoriented, is unwell and doesn't really understand what's happening, or maybe they're a psychiatric issue? And then how much of it is just somebody who's impatient, has no regard for others?
Well, generally speaking, where there's a psychiatric issue or there's a threat of violence, and that's established, those patients would be special. So there would be increased levels of staff there to surveillance. So that would be catered for. But this is kind of a situation like, over the last number of years, because of COVID, the amount of presentations in hospitals, you know, has increased threefold. So, like, in the month of June, there was nearly 10,000 patients waiting on trolleys. So you can see that when you've got an overcrowded emergency department,
you have a pressure cooker.
The pressure cooker has gone on, and you've seen also during the week that some of the patient groups are saying that one of the biggest difficulties they have is communications. So people can't get, you know, relatives can't get access to into the hospitals, and there's understandable frustration that they're not hearing how their loved one is doing, etc. And that can lead to all sorts of aggression building up.
I speak personally, having been on the other side of that. Not that it excuses aggression, but it certainly justifies frustration. So how do you solve that? How do you get that channeled straight into the ED where the information can be solved?
Yeah, well, one of the measures, for instance, like you may recall, Will, last year in July, we had a protest in Mullingar Hospital over the staffing shortages. And this was in the height of in COVID. And one of the measures that was agreed with the hospital locally that had some good effect was that they placed extra clerical staff on the ward and in the emergency department that it would at least be able to deal with those type of queries. So it wouldn't divert nurses from having to ring patients, relatives, et cetera, so they could attend to the care. So that's a practical measure. But I think really, with the hospitals themselves really need to have to step up their own security and training of staff in dealing with violence and aggression. Also, as you know, it is a criminal offence to assault a healthcare worker, etc. And really, the employers need to take responsibility for that and to send the message out that it won't be tolerated and that the prosecutions will be sought. Now, to date,
the signage to that effect is in place, but is there an unwillingness to follow through?
There is an unwillingness to follow through because sometimes nurses themselves who have been subject to assault don't want to report it or find it difficult to report it.
Why would they find it difficult?
Part of it is because it's unreported because it's become normalised that it's part of their work. They just don't want the hassle of having to report it, to give statements to the guards, give statements to managers, etc. And rather than put themselves through all that, they just suck it up rather than report them. So we have a job of work to do in terms of advising the members that they need to report it. Mm. The IMO is in the process of training up safety reps so we can advise our members locally on the ground what to do and to identify risks. This is not just an emergency problem. It's a problem across the full campus because all of the hospitals are overcrowded.
I appreciate that, but when you read in the paper or you hear on the radio that somebody has appeared in court that they were abusive to a nurse or to a doctor, they receive whatever the punishment may be, hopefully a sufficient deterrent, that would have a chilling effect on anybody who'd think twice about doing it again.
Well, that's what needs to happen, that there needs to be more prosecutions. And the employers, like... You see, when you look at that figure I gave you earlier, that the health takes up one third of the workforce, had nearly the highest amount of incidents reported, but the lowest inspections by the Health and Safety Authority. So Health and Safety Authority is not going around doing the job that it should be doing. It's regarding healthcare as safe. Now, rightly so, that there's been a lot of focus by the Health and Safety Authority on construction and farming over recent years because there's fatalities, but no nurse or no midwife wants to go to work to end up being abused when they're giving care, or worse still, being assaulted. So I really think that there is a role for the health and safety to look at its own performance and also to establish sufficient resources. And it's one of the things that we have asked of the Health and Safety Authority directly to establish, because this is an ongoing problem. This is unfortunately the third time thing I will have spoke to you about this issue, and it's not going away.
Albert, grateful for your time. Thanks for raising it again.
Thank you, Will.
Albert Murphy of the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation. And if you're a nurse, or indeed a doctor, healthcare assistant, any person who works in a healthcare setting and has to endure abuse, what triggers it? What is the solution? And what is the appropriate punishment too? Here's a message relating to the FLA. Well done, Tomás Nally. I'm so looking forward to the event. It is brilliant that it is returning to its birthplace, and we shall make the most of it. That's from Phil Brown in Castle Pollard. And another caller asks, well, during the FLA, what about B&Bs charging €150 for bed only? Surely that is rip off Ireland. And there are other texts here, and this isn't by any means a fault on the FLA committee, but there are people renting out houses for thousands of euro during the week of the FLA, and surely that's going to leave a bad taste in the mouths of tourists. That's the message that we're getting. But a lot of support for what Tomás Nally has said, and indeed for the FLA committee, and to make the most of it, we shall. One slight difficulty, and it's more than slight actually, for the Order of Malta volunteers who will be busy, busy, busy bees during the FLA, they have nowhere to stay. The charity has 80 volunteers who, according to Sinn Féin, will be left sleeping on floors and have no access to showers or to bathrooms. And the local Longford Westmeath TD, Circa Clark, raised this issue with Micheál Martin in the Dáil, and the Taoiseach said he would follow up on the matter.
Now, for almost a year, the Order of Malta in Mullingar have repeatedly sought engagement with the HSE and the Department of Health. Applications have been sent, calls have been made, emails have been sent, and not a single one of them, Taoiseach, has been responded to.
Bizarre. You would imagine the HSE would take an issue, take an interest in such an issue, but there you go. Now, not too far from Mullingar, the Hill of Ushnuk stands proudly, and indeed there are festivals and there are many people who use the hill for recreational purposes. And it also happens to be on the tentative list for World Heritage Site status. Now, what on earth does that mean, the tentative list? Ruth Illingworth is a local historian, and she's been involved, oh, going back to about 2013 when the paperwork began. Good morning, Ruth.
Morning, Will.
So, to explain what a World Heritage Site status would bring in prestige, but also in restrictions, can you give us some background?
Well, the World Heritage status is granted by the United Nations Cultural Agency, UNESCO, and it's been on the go since 1972. And UNESCO sites are places recognised as having outstanding universal value as a part of the whole planet, the whole of humanity's cultural and heritage. Here in Ireland, UNESCO sites include, well, Giant's Causeway in Northern Ireland, the Brú na Bóinne site, which includes Newgrange in the Boyne Valley, and Skellig Michael in Kerry. And there are many, many. There are about, a thousand or so UNESCO World Heritage Sites around the world at the moment.
And what would be the case for putting the Hill of Ushnuk in the league of those you've just mentioned?
Well, Ushnuk is going in, it's part of what is known as the Royal Assembly Sites of Iron Age Ireland. And we're not standing alone, we're in along with Tara, Cashel, Rathcrohan in Roscommon, which is the Royal Centre of Connacht, Dunallan in Kildare, which is the Leinster site. And these were, it's an example of a kind of a civilization, a kind of Celtic civilization, a way of ordering society and running society, which survived longer in Ireland than in any other part of Celtic Europe, largely because we weren't invaded by the Romans. In the case of Ushnuk, particularly Ushnuk was regarded as the sacred centre of pre-Christian Ireland. So it's a place of enormous cultural and archaeological significance in Irish history, and indeed we would argue in the wider history of Europe and the world.
So if it is granted this status, apart from, as you've outlined, the great company it will keep and the prestige and the tourist interest that brings, what would be the restrictions that follow?
Not certain about that, it would probably come into the ownership of the state. I'm not totally certain about that, but I'm not at the moment. It's a privately owned farm. The owners, David and Angela Clark, take their responsibilities as what they call guardians of the hill very seriously, and they've done great work in looking after the site. But I would imagine it would probably come into the OPW would take ownership, because I'm not aware of any privately owned UNESCO World Heritage sites. There are UNESCO sites that are, for example, working buildings like cathedrals, but it would be it would certainly mean more funding for the hill and for the work that's been done there, even kind of in the over the last number of years, as we've set out the case of being on the tentative list. A great deal of work has been done there, archaeological work, particularly by Dr. Roseanne Schott of Galway University. We've had put together biodiversity plans and other plans for the management of the hill. The Westmeath Heritage Officer, Melanie McQuaid, has done great work in helping to organise this. So it's been of benefit to the hill for enabling us to understand more about its significance and its history, and in sort of putting together plans for how we manage visitors to the hill, because we are open for tours at the moment 6 days a week, public tours, that's enabled us to organise those better and to work at being able to have people come to a hill which is also a working farm.
We will have a longer conversation about this as the process continues. We're coming to the news at 10 now, unfortunately, but getting on the tentative list is a bit like a step towards sainthood.
It's a big step.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When eventually would this be completed?
Well, it's that over the next year now, with the help of the government's department of the culture department, local government, environment, we'll start the process of putting together a nomination bid papers that will eventually go to UNESCO. These will involve archaeologists, historians, and other people with skills relevant to our understanding of the hill and why, making the case for why it is worthy of what is described as outstanding universal value, which UNESCO requires to give world heritage status to a site. So the process is ongoing. We're working with people who've been involved in world heritage bids for places like Hadrian's Wall in Britain. So it's a big step forward. Being on the tentative list is an incredible honour, and it's important. But there'll be work ahead. This process is going to take a few years. It's by no means certain that being on the tentative list doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get the actual UNESCO status, but it's a step forward.
Ruth Illingworth, appreciate you making time for us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Will.
Good morning. Happy Friday. Hope you're in good form. Forest Fest, the first year ever. It's about to get underway in Emo today, and we'll be taking you to the site and having a little sneak peek around and previewing what should be the event of the summer. And, well, that's one in County Laois, the FLA, of course. A different music market, 500,000 people coming to Mullingar in just over a week's time, and comments continue to come in huge support of the organising committee and endorsing what Tomás Nally said earlier, that it is an opportunity to be embraced and to be enjoyed. And yes, there may be a little inconvenience for some, but at the end of the day, the benefits outweigh the losses. Or do you disagree? 083 30 10 103 on text and WhatsApp. The Friday panel shall be here as well to take you through the big stories of the week and the super fruit that, if you are an older lady, you need this in your diet. It lowers your blood pressure, staves off cardiovascular disease, and it's not a rare fruit. I'll tell you exactly what it is in a few minutes. AIB is being told by no less than the Taoiseach himself that it should not withdraw ATM services from Edenderry, from Birr, from Rathdowney, and from 67 other locations around the country, in an announcement that appears to have taken the government by surprise. Pascal Donoghue, the finance minister, by all accounts knew nothing about this. It has been raised through Fianna Fáil by Laois Offaly TD and Junior Finance Minister Sean Fleming. We're trying to contact him to see if he'll appear on the programme and tell us what the government will do about it, considering it is the largest shareholder in AIB Bank. But let's explore what has been a trend over many years, the withdrawal of banking services from the commercial operators, and what the alternative may well be. Seamus Boland is the chief executive of Irish Rural Link. His organisation has argued in the past for community banking and pointed to other countries in Europe that have used this model successfully. Seamus, good morning.
Good morning, Will.
So give us a case study. Where does this well and how does it work?
Well, the case study we put forward was the bank in Germany. We could have picked a few other countries as well. Sparkas are the main operator in Germany, and they cover mainly what I would call the medium to small enterprises with some large ones thrown in. And effectively, they operate as a fully fledged bank. The difference from the normal banking system is they don't have shareholders. They're not part of the corporate stuff. And in fact, when the European banking crisis hit, Sparkas escaped completely from the worst effects, in fact, from most effects of the banking crisis. And as I said, because it's a completely different model in the sense, it's like cooperative banking. It looks, the ordinary savers or users become the shareholders, if you like. They become the people that you account in terms of your business. And it means they're not connected to what's called the banking corporate world, which is where Bank of Ireland and AIB are.
What would be the difference between Sparkas and what we know here in Ireland as credit unions?
Very little, frankly. And in fact, we would have argued in our proposal that you could look at the credit union system and devise legislation to effectively parallel or let the credit union control the whole thing. But you'd need to parallel part of it into what would be called the banking system. The credit union system is there mainly to ensure that moneylenders don't get a grip on in our society, and that's one of the main reasons we strongly support them. However, the larger credit unions, and there is a lot of money in the system in terms of the credit unions, with the correct legislation, with some work in terms of the Department of Finance, etc., we could actually build the proposal we had on the credit union system. It does mean some legislative changes, but it is possible. But the thing
what would be the enhancements? What would be the changes the credit unions would need to embrace?
The main problem with, I think Charlie McCreevy tried to do something back in the day, and the problem was that the rules relating to the credit union, because especially they have to give loans to the smaller borrowers, and sometimes borrowers would know real serious collateral because the credit union was based on the community system of knowing people. Those rules would have to change. And so in other words, under current banking legislation, the credit union would end up being just the same as another bank. What we were proposing was, allow the credit union to continue, and one part of it to do what it does today, what it normally does, gets us all out of trouble from time to time, but hive off part of it to become a kind of not a commercial banking in the normal sense, but a public banking system. And that would match what they've done in Germany or the cooperative bank in Britain, which would mean you would have a connection. You might have two separate boards. But we had the details worked out. But in terms of the customer, there's really no difference. It simply means that the credit union would become effectively a bank as well as a lending institution for the smaller or the borrowers in hardship, etc. So it's a matter of doing. You need new legislation to do it. You'd need permission of the central banks, but to do it everywhere else, so we could do it as well.
Mm. And there is another potential player, because credit unions are concentrated usually in the larger towns, county towns certainly. The post office network is much more widely spread out. Would that be an option?
Yeah, and just before I finish on that, like the ACC were effectively a bank, and so was the ICC, the Industrial Credit. So Ireland did this. It's not something new to us. But in terms of the post office system, okay, like we heard some reports this morning, even in the newspapers, etc. I don't think the post office even know about this so-called deepening understanding, which is what the AIB spin put on it. They're developing some deep understanding relationship. As of now, the post offices don't have the kind of infrastructure needed to be effectively taking the place of a bank. What they are is they complement banking services. In some cases, depending on where the post office, that can be a good service or a limited service, depending on a whole range of local factors. So the post office, even for this announcement, the post office system isn't even ready for this. From what I gather, they hardly know about it. Now, think about it, Will. If you have a post office in a local village and the local pub has a good night's taking and it has to lodge, do you really think it's safe to be lodging this cash in maybe where there isn't enough security built around it? It's not thought out, which is the problem. I don't know. The post office has their own bank as well. We would have argued that that was another way you could build your public banking system. But as it stands, the post office network, which was reduced considerably as well, is really not probably fit at the moment. Maybe if they deepen this so-called understanding, they will. But right now, I don't think it's possible.
Of course, a third way would be to change the regulatory requirements on the commercial banks and to maintain a certain maybe public service level, have ATMs in villages of a minimum size or something to that effect. A listener has made an interesting point here. If in Germany, Spartas provides finance to small, medium enterprises, micro businesses, farmers and so on, who does business with the main commercial banks? Who's left?
Well, the commercial banks in Germany are still quite large and they command a huge part of not just the German but the European market. Here's the thing, Will. The commercial banks, the best way to describe it is as follows. Let's say you're a banker. You have 10 Will Faulkners turning over maybe half a million, 2 million each. That's a small business, believe it or not. That's 10 accounts. Seamus Boland walks in, he owns half the world, Trump Towers, a lot. You only need one account. Mm. So the corporate banking system relies on the massive big accounts. That's where it's most comfortable. That's actually where it always was most comfortable. That's why in Ireland we set up the Agricultural Credit Cooperation. That's why we set up the Industrial Credit. Because even then, back in the 60s, the banks didn't want the small person. They still don't want it because the return on shares is too low. Remember, these businesses are only returning a profit of 3 to 4%. That's not enough for the corporate banker. So, unfortunately, the corporate banker and AIB are still trying to be one, even though they're a state bank, and Bank of Ireland the same. All the other ones are gone. You know, does that not tell you something if all the others are gone?
So they're looking for scale, and ultimately... Yes. Most small and medium enterprises and certainly individuals can't provide that. It's a conversation that we will continue, Seamus. I'm grateful for your time and thank you at last for confessing to your secret millions.
Well, as long as I know you're a small business, I'm happy. At least I can look down on you for a while.
Good luck. Seamus Boland is Chief Executive of Irish Rural Link. If you've lived in Germany, would be particularly interested to hear your views on Spartas and community banking in general, if you've lived overseas and have had to deal with them, and what the difference would be in attitude and culture between those examples and the commercial banks, particularly AIB and Bank of Ireland, our two, quote, pillar banks here. Forest Fest is kicking off in Emo today and all is ready to go. We'll be checking in on the site in around half an hour. Brian Adams and Heaven. DJ Sammy did a version of that a few years later as well. The candlelight version was especially beautiful. And we are going to dedicate that not alone to the couple getting married today, but to Ayrton Delaney in Kilbride Gardens in Clara, who is celebrating the big 1-0. He's 10 today into double digits. And best wishes from Auntie Martina in Pulla. Have a great day, Ayrton. If you're in Longford, Westmeath, if you're driving around the roads of Mullingar, Athlone, Moat, up into Edgeworthstown and so on, good news. You must be driving very, very safely because the Gorthy and the people who operate the Go Safe vans, they're not creating any new locations for speed traps. However, they are publishing 61 locations elsewhere in the country. They're even tackling a few local roads. Normally you'd see them on the nationals or the regionals. For instance, in Kildare, the L2032, I have no idea where exactly that is, you'll have to look it up, but it's a sign that they're going off the beaten track a bit with some of these new locations. So, if you are in Leash Offaly and you travel the R420, there shall be a new location where the speed traps will be set up. N62 in Leash Offaly as well. Don't know exactly where. They have listed some of the coordinates, and it would, well, take all day to call out 53.34, blah, blah, blah. So we're not going to do that. But I think if you're travelling along the N62, the R420, the R441, watch out, there will be some new locations for the Go Safe vans. And otherwise, the motorway network, M8, Leash Offaly, again, doesn't say where, that could be just about any stretch, and the M6 as well. And, you know, that again could be a wide variety of possibilities. So generally, slow down. I think that's the safest and most sensible and most cost-effective option. So GoSafe publishing 61 locations, new locations. So look it up on their website if you're very, very curious and in a hurry. Just after 10:30, and still on the menu today, the superfruit that every woman should be eating. Music lovers from across Ireland shall descend on County Leash in the coming hours. Tonight, Jack L., The Four of Us, Power of Dreams, Ham Sandwich, Hermitage Green. They're just some of the artists performing at Forest Fest. And over the course of the weekend, the stunning Something Happens, Monday, the Riptide Movement, the Water Boys, Paddy Casey, Damien Dempsey. The list goes on and on and on and on and on and on. So let's get a tour with words as Philip Marr, the promoter, takes us around the site in Emo. Good morning, Philip.
Good morning, Will. How are you? Beautiful day in Emo here. I'm standing outside the church, looking across at the concert venue. It looks absolutely amazing. All our colourful banners went up yesterday, so it's really given it that festival feel. Blue skies here, and all of our stages are up, so it just looks incredible this morning. I'm really looking forward to seeing people here later on.
One question, an important one for those who may be thinking, I'd love to go, but are the tickets still left?
There are some tickets still available. Unfortunately, our camper van and our caravan tickets are all sold out. We have a very limited number of tent tickets available, but your normal daily tickets and weekend tickets are still available. So they're all on forestfest.ie still. And also we will have a ticket booth each day starting at 4 o'clock this afternoon if people just want to walk up and buy tickets. But our ticket sales have been fantastic. We're going to have a really good crowd here over the weekend. It's just going to be a really, really great party for the whole weekend.
What's the policy on children, Philip?
Yeah, well, we're obviously anxious. The whole team is a family fun kind of weekend. We're going for vibe, and the children under 12 are all free, and we have tons of families bringing stuff, and we have a big entertainment schedule for all of the kids. We have a circus tent here that you'll see. It's the kind of pop-up color that you see as you're driving past the site at the moment, and we have circus shows, circus skills classes for all of the kids. We have the Port Darlington Art Collective are coming with various tents of activities, so there's tons of stuff for the kids, and we have a carnival here as well, so lots of fun for the kids, and as I say, the kids under 12 are free.
This is your first foray into promoting a music festival. You're a legal professional by background. What was the experience like?
It's been fantastic. We've been working with an incredible team from Dublin who run such events as the Galway Arts Festival, the Dublin City Celebrations for Patrick's Day and so forth. It's just been an incredible experience. It's a very steep learning curve for me. It's new for me. But a lovely community, the arts community, they're good people. And we've had a ball, and we've you know, that we've a great bunch of guys working behind the scene. I'm actually looking across the scene, there's probably 150 guys in high-vis jackets running around just putting the gold dust on the site as we speak. So we're very, very nearly ready for guests now. Hopefully this afternoon we kick off nicely around 4:30 or 5 o'clock.
Here's the question that will make you hate me and it'll get you into trouble. But what are you most looking forward to over the weekend?
As in axe-wise?
Exactly.
Yeah, axe-wise. Well, look, a personal favourite of mine is I've grown up listening to Neil Young. Harvest, who are a tribute to Neil Young, they're coming on at about 6:15. So that'll be a treat for me. They're an amazing, amazing night. I would encourage you to come early because you don't want to miss these guys. They're absolutely fantastic. We all grew up with bands like The Four of Us, and Something Happens and The Stunning. They're going to be huge highlights for me as well. We did a sound check with The Stunning last night, and you won't believe this, it's the sound system of the Pyramid Glastonbury.
Wow.
It's absolutely amazing. We were just very lucky to have a choice of equipment this weekend, and this became available and we grabbed this with two hands. And the stage is probably the third biggest stage from Glastonbury, again, that came in from the UK last weekend. So it just looks amazing. The Stunning, the sound last night was just incredible. It's like stadium sound. So I'd say The Stunning, Something Happens, big highlights. Obviously, the Water Boys on Sunday night are going to be terrific as well. They're quite a great act. And they're over abroad at the moment. They're traveling over tomorrow or Saturday night, getting into us on Sunday morning. So that'll be another highlight.
Well, we're looking ahead this evening to nice, dry, balmy conditions, perfect for kicking off Forest Fest, and tickets are still available at forestfest.ie. Philip, enjoy it. The hard work is done, so time to relax and enjoy the fruit of your labour.
Well, not quite there yet, Will, but in a couple of hours we get back a little bit more. But listen, thanks for all your help and support over the last couple of months.
A pleasure.
Thanks, Will.
We'll see you there. Philip Marr.